Welcome to the RSP cast. This is the, episode 11, not really episode 11, week 11 of the Quick Game with Mark Schofield and I. Mark, it's always a pleasure when we get a chance to do this show.
Yeah, man, I love this one. I know the listeners like it too. I know my parents like it. It's fun. We cover a ton of stuff. We inevitably get to like a half of the questions that you send over before we do it, because you and I have a tendency to go long when we can, even when we're under a time limit like we are here. But I just love doing the show. It's a ton of fun each time we get to do it, and I can't wait to dive in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't we do that? And that gives me a chance to figure out my timer again.
Yeah, same here. And we're doing it like we did a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to ask the questions, let Matt go first, and give us a chance to sort of flip things around, and I'll be able to riff off of Matt. And we'll open it on a topic somewhat near and dear to my heart. Now, Matt, what does the move from Josh Gordon to Mohamed Sanu say about Gordon and or Tom Brady in the Patriots offense?
All right. I'm going to take a timeout right away. Yep. Right out of the gate. Because this is my pretty obvious version of saying, hey, read my article at Football Guys. But I wrote something about Josh Gordon, and I was kind of looking into why would the Patriots let him go? If, of course, Seattle kind of looked into his circumstances and Gordon's not about to be suspended, and and the answers might be, well, he's just not good anymore, because that's like the simple answer that a lot of people like to give. But then I think, well, he actually had some of the best stats in terms of efficiency and some of the work that he did to compared to, say, Randy Moss, and without the caliber of surrounding talent Moss had during those years. And he did get up to speed within about 3 weeks with New England when he first came aboard in 2018. So what was it? And yes, Gordon, took some time away from the game, and people said, well, it was the talk was that he was facing another suspension. But if you look at, how much he's played over the past 2 years, which is what, 15 games so far compared to, or 19 games thus far, which is compared to the 15 he had in 3 years, he must be making progress with his rehab. And considering that, people were dubious about him maybe initiating, the mental health break because he was getting another suspension impending. It seems to me that he's worked with the NFL to the extent that they seem to know where he's at, and he keeps getting more chances. So it's kind of like, if you say he's not talented enough, then right, you can't say that he's getting chances because he's talented. His production was pretty good. But when you start looking at the Patriots numbers, last year and some of this year, Tom Brady's deep game is 30th in the league last year in terms of accuracy. If you look at tight window throws, he's middle of the pack. And to me, tight window throws are what most people say is NFL open. And I don't mean, and I'm not banging on Tom Brady because he's a great player. I think it's just people will perceive it that way because we look at it so simply. Every quarterback has flaws. And I think Tom Brady's flaws right now is that if you want college open, receivers get college open, he's one of the best in the league still at throwing at two steps or more, or up to two steps, according to Pro Football Focus. But if it's a tight window throw within arm's reach, he's a middle of the pack quarterback. So from a physical standpoint, he's okay at this point in his career. But from a conceptual, mental, pocket-oriented standpoint in terms of playing the game and leveraging to his strengths, he and the Patriots are unfrickin' believable because they use these receivers in the system to be like quarterbacks on their own and understand where the ball needs to be placed based on their routes as they're running their routes.
I'll let you go. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going.
Which very few teams do, which is why, oh, man, I'm already out. That's okay. Teams are already, most wide receivers, I think if you look at Chad Johnson, you look at Brandon Lloyd, Nate Washington, Reggie Wayne, Eric Decker, these are guys who were good with good offenses and good quarterbacks. And then when they came to the New England, they just flopped, and they struggled, or they just weren't nearly as good. And I think a lot of it is what's been discussed in the past on, you know, various Patriots outlets, is that you have to think like a quarterback and you have to actually evolve your route in mid route sometimes in ways that a lot of teams don't do. So I think most of the onus of route of wide receiver play or getting wide open for Tom Brady, most of the onus is, or much more of the onus is on the wide receivers. They have to do more mental conceptual work than your average receiver. And, but the, you know, and while that's hard for a lot of receivers in the league because they're not used to doing that, it makes life a lot easier for Tom Brady in this offense because Tom Brady gets a lot of more wide open looks, if you ask me, that he takes advantage of. And it's not a ding on Tom Brady. It's really more a praise to this offensive system and the receivers and the demands that the coaching staff make for them to get this right, to the point that even if you have guys that are top players that can't get involved, you know, early on, or top players that come into the league and they don't transition well to the Patriots, they find other guys who can, who have that conceptual skill. And to me, it's just highlights that the Patriots are very much about a system and finding players who fit that system and kind of working within Tom Brady's strengths. And so what I think that says is they don't need a deep ball, you know, back shoulder fade, post route running, you know, go route type of guy in terms of what Brady does best. They need a guy more like Sanu, who's a big slot receiver who can play outside, but reads the field and processes things quickly. And it doesn't seem like Gordon didn't do that, but if you have Josh Gordon and all you want to throw are slant routes and in cuts in terms of that's what they do best, and you're not taking advantage of the best of his game, why keep him when you can get someone else in who may be able to do a little bit more for you that fits Brady better? And I think that that's kind of also a sense of how the Patriots move on, like good teams do, from players who are still good enough in their game. So I think this more has to do with the fit with what works best for Tom Brady in this offense, as opposed to Josh Gordon being bad and all the things that are going to be said about him because of the things that he's already earned from his past behavior.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Matt. You know, when you look at where the Patriots are right now as an offense and trying to find their offensive identity, I think we saw a glimpse of where they want to be against Baltimore. They want to be a quick pass and up-tempo game with some stuff based off of play action, you know, and you can make the argument that the Patriots have sort of come full circle in the Tom Brady era, where they began, you know, their dynasty run with a ball controlled short passing attack built around their defense. And that's kind of what they've become here at the end. And I think that it was just a better fit with Sanu in this system. And the point you raised about the onus that is put on the wide receivers in the New England offense is an incredibly apt one, this incredibly accurate one, because if you read and study their playbook, you will see that every route concept has multiple conversions built into it based on what the defense has shown them. And when people ask me all the time, how do you stop Tom Brady? One of the things that I will bring up is you have to spin the safeties at the snap. You have to rotate your coverage at the snap and do it crisply and effectively. And people say, why? You're not going to confuse Tom Brady. And I say, that's exactly right. You won't confuse Tom Brady. You're not trying to confuse 12. You're trying to confuse 11 or 13 or 14. Because if you get Brady on a different page than his wide receivers, the time and the rhythm and the execution will all be off. And those are the core tenets of the New England passing game. And so if you can't sort of figure that stuff out, if you can't, like you said, think like a quarterback, and Mohamed Sanu is a former quarterback, then you might struggle. And so I think you put that together, that's why Sanu was a better fit for them right now.
Yeah, I think that's great. And, you know, I think the best – we could use a wildlife analogy and kind of say that Tom Brady's kind of like the queen ant in the ant colony, and the wide receivers are kind of like the soldier ants, where like they can send, you know, they kind of have that mind meld thing going on that when there's danger, you know, they can sense it, you know. And yep, it's like if you get rid of, they're kind of an extension of Tom Brady, or it's some sort of weird alien creature, I don't know, so from a science fiction movie. Yep. But it's interesting.
I think that mind meld is what they're searching for on every single offensive play. And, you know, you need to have that. Otherwise, the offense isn't going to work. And so I think these are all good points.
Yeah, and I think with
– Let's move on to
– Yeah, go ahead. And then we're done with the quick game there. We're done with the long game for the quick game, right?
Yeah, those are the ball control drives. We'll try to, you know, pick the tempo up a bit like that New England offense did against Baltimore. And speaking of offenses, we might have seen an offense sort of figure out a bit of their offensive identity out in Cleveland. Matt, your thoughts on the Nick Chubb, Kareem Hunt backfield?
Yeah, I love it. And it kind of reminds me of the Cleveland Browns of my youth with Kevin Mack and Ernest Biner in terms of two good backs who can run the ball but are unselfish enough to do a lot of the little things. And Kareem Hunt said this week, you know, that he was Nick Chubb's biggest cheerleader. And you know, that's probably all the right things you want to hear him say coming back from a suspension and talking about all the journaling and the things that he's done off the field. But watching him play, watching him lead block on outside zone, watching him cut block, you know, edge defenders the way that he did, I believe him because he's playing like a team-oriented player. And then, of course, they hand him the ball and he's still running the way that you would have expected Kareem Hunt in his prime to run. I mean, he looked good out there. And I think, and we know Nick Chubb is an unselfish player. So you put those two guys together, you move them around the backfield, do a lot of things that maybe Green Bay did, where you can move Kareem Hunt to the outside. And now you create more weapons, both from the running game standpoint, that are versatile and that you can't really key on one guy. And it helps Baker Mayfield in the passing game too. So I'm excited about at least the end of the season with this. We'll see what happens with Hunt maybe down the stretch in terms of whether they decide to trade him after the season.
Yeah, and I think, Matt, the play that you sort of touched on, that sort of outside blocking on an outside zone play, was what gave me the most hope about how this is actually going to work, because we know that this is sort of a matchup league, right? And if you can sort of dictate defensive personnel to the defense and then have athletes still on the field that can beat those matchups and win those matchups, you're going to be successful as an offense. And to see Kareem Hunt sort of lead blocking and taking on Micah Hyde, who's running the alley on an outside zone play to get, you know, Nick Chubb, sprint him for a run down to the 1 yard line early in the first quarter. That's going to be huge because it gives you the ability as an offense to perhaps go with tempo, or even if you don't, if you catch them, you know, in a sub package, you can now run at that with Hunt as your lead blocker and you're going to be effective. And if teams start seeing that, then maybe they stay in base. And what do? Then you use Hunt or Chubb or both of them as receivers in the passing game. And it's a way to sort of create matchups, favorable matchups to you as an offense, and then exploit them. And so that usage, using him as a fullback, getting that buy-in from him is going to be huge. I love the opportunity in front of Cleveland right now with these two running backs to sort of move this offensive forward and maybe to get where they want it to be as an offense.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it's one of those things that as long as Baker Mayfield can trust Kareem Hunt on some of these timing routes to the outside that he failed to do early in the game but started to do later, that can be big.
Let's look at some of the players in the lower level, though, that I know you and I both do a ton of work looking at. And those are some of the college quarterbacks. We obviously saw the big Joe Burrow, Tua Tagovailoa game, Alabama, LSU. But, Matt, talk about your current thoughts about a college quarterback who has caught your eye, whether good or bad.
For me, I talked about him on the Ross Tucker show today or last week or this coming week, is Jake Fromm out of Georgia. I haven't really studied Jake Fromm until this year. And I know that a lot of people are like, well, you live in Georgia, you worked at Georgia. I'm really not a Georgia fan. I'm one of those fans that, like, I'm happy for my friends. And if we hang out to watch a game, I'm happy for them that they're cheering for him and I'll cheer for them. But it's not, you know, it's not in deep in my heart to be a Georgia fan. So I really haven't kept up with Fromm on a level of watching him until I've just decided to collect enough games. But this weekend, I watched a ton of his games and charted a lot of his work. And I came away extremely impressed with his game. You know, this is a guy who reads the blitz pretty well. I think he can work outside the pocket within his athletic ability and make throws that you see some pro players are able to make that are, you know, pinpoint, give his receivers chances to win. I love his pocket presence. I just think that he moves with that economic kind of incremental economic type of movement when the pressure comes, and then when multiple points of pressure come, he can maneuver that. And when he does need to break the pocket, he can do so. So he just has a really good feel for that. And I like the accuracy of his game. I like that he has a good enough arm to make the opposite hash throws. This is a guy that, right now for me, I mean, I still have a lot more to watch with some of the top guys. I mean, I've watched them, but as far as guys who've put together complete performances in my evaluations thus far, Jake Fromm is one of the best.
Wow, that's very high praise for Jake Fromm, who's a player I think might sort of be a bit of a polarizing prospect. I've watched him some. I know he's going to get sort of that old school pro style quarterback love that we sometimes see, a guy that runs like the pro style offense, but he's got a bit more to him. So I think people will like him. I want to talk about Nate Stanley for a second, because he's a player that we're probably going to see up close in person. I would imagine he's going to be down in Mobile for the Senior Bowl. And I know there's been some rumbling amongst the sort of the scout and draft world about this might not be the best senior quarterback class. You've got Herbert, you've got Burrow. Who knows if they get to the Senior Bowl, if they accept the invites, if they go or not. After that, it's a bit thin. Stanley's interesting because you think about quarterbacks that are going to get that sort of under the center, back to the defense, play action type of vibe that we'd like to see from quarterbacks at times and that we know the NFL likes. And Stanley certainly checks that box. There are things that he does that I don't like. Like you see him against, I believe it was Wisconsin. There was a throw he had where he got a blitz off the edge, and the lower body mechanics in response to pressure are not what you like to see. Really sort of ducks away from it, bends his body away from it, really impacts the placement on the throw. But he has incredible arm. And over the course of the past couple of years, I've started to sort of refigure, retool my view and approach on how the arm strength does matter. And if you need a guy to just rip one bang eight post route in the middle of coverage, he can do it. And there are things that he can bring to the table as a quarterback that I think will get some people excited the more they start to watch him. He's not the sexiest prospect. There are some things that he does that I don't like. Like I said, the response to pressure. But with some process and speed plays that he's made, he had a great throw late against Wisconsin, a bucket throw downfield as well. But an earlier throw where he put a route in the end zone on a pivot route, low and away, feeling the leverage. I think there's something to this kid. So Nate Stanley is somebody to keep an eye on over the next couple of weeks.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I've certainly watched him, and I can understand from an athletic standpoint and from a skills standpoint physically, there is definitely a lot there. And there are some moments that you look at him and go, yeah, I can definitely see why a team would be hopeful about his future.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of get that, like, it's easy to say sort of C.J. Beathard because it's the same school, but you get that sense that there's going to be at least one coach that's like, I could make this work. And so you might see him come off the board earlier than we expect. So, you know, that always happens. Speaking of a quarterback that is playing for a guy that drafted C.J. Beathard, that's Jimmy Garoppolo. And he had we can call it a shaky performance Monday night. Matt, what were your thoughts from the performance we saw Monday night from Mr. Garoppolo?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you saw was a player who nearly nosedived and pulled himself out of it before he completely crashed. And I think he got some help from the Seattle defense because they didn't catch the pair of interceptions down the, you know, at the end of the game there that he nearly threw or should have thrown. But what I see with him is it's a magnified version of what you see from him every week. He teeters that edge of losing control when it comes to pressure situations. I love his quick feet. I love how economical he can move in the pocket. He has a great release. You know, you're seeing moments of him being able to read leverage and find the open man in zone. He's really, you know, his game started to take off with Emmanuel Sanders in the lineup and having a predictable receiver he can throw to that does the things that most quarterbacks understand the receiver's supposed to do in a route, as he talked about. But, you know, it seems like when the pressure comes and you're tempted to play too fast, he falls into that trap too often, whether it's a defender in his face or he starts to feel the pressure, even though the defender is 4 or 5 steps away. He rushes throws, and even in good weeks where it doesn't look bad, defenders can be a few steps away from him, and he's one of those guys that throws in a way to protect his body at the end of the release. And you might say, well, that's okay, right? I mean, you want to protect yourself. And I'd say, yes, that absolutely. But there, it's just a little bit more exaggerated with Garoppolo. It's almost like he's not afraid of getting hurt. I mean, of getting hit. He's just afraid of getting hurt. And I think it shows up in his game.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And it's just kind of where I wanted to start with this, because, you know, when I think about Garoppolo this season, I sort of put him in a bucket like I did last year with both Deshaun Watson and Carson Wentz. When you've got quarterbacks coming off that ACL injury, I think you have to give them a little bit more leeway in terms of what you see from them when they come back. You know, because while medical advances have enabled these guys to come back quicker than might be humanly possible for the rest of us, there's still that uncertainty in the lower body. There's that uncertainty when you step into a throw, if the lower body is going to be there for you. There's that fear that you don't want to get hit again. And I think, you know, that's still playing a role for him. And so I'm sort of grading him on a bit of a different curve than I might say other quarterbacks right now because of that factor. But there's something more concerning with him. And it's a play that won't even go down in the stat sheet. It's a play that got negated due to a defensive holding penalty. But he had a throw on a 3rd and 5 in the first quarter where he had an in cut and it was wide open and it was open early. And it was one of those situations where he had the right leverage and vantage. And he stares it down and he waits 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 and he finally throws it and it gets intercepted. That to me is more concerning than some of the other stuff, because yes, he was pressured in this game, but here he's waiting too long. And I don't expect to see that from a more experienced quarterback like him. And so that's what I want to see more of. Is he doing stuff like that more frequently or not?
Yeah. And I think the answer right now early on for Garoppolo is he a franchise quarterback? And I think the answer is, if you're going to give it a simple answer and just be like a hard ass about it, the answer is no. He's not right now. The first test he had, he kind of wet the bed, but that doesn't mean that he won't get enough training to be able to hold that water down the line. And this was his first real big game, I think, of his career in the NFL.
Speaking of 49ers skill players, there's one that has people starting to worry, especially those in the wide receiver evaluation community, and that's Dante Pettis. And Matt, the question is simply this: what's wrong with him?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things. I mean, I think to start off with, Garoppolo said last year that it was, you know, that Pettis is an unusual player in the way that he runs routes and gets open. So he's not an easy player to read for a young quarterback. And that's why the predictability of what Emmanuel Sanders does has been so important and why they brought him in there. I think Pettis is also kind of an unusual guy in terms of his personality. I don't want to, you know, late when I say he's like Arian Foster, I'm not saying in personality on the level of like everything, just that they're probably a little bit more unconventional for what the NFL looks at, which really shouldn't be a big deal. But if you're, you know, if you're a regimented coach like Kyle Shanahan, that may rub you the wrong way a little bit. And I'm speculating with that. But more than anything, I think Pettis got banged up early on. I think that he probably didn't play to his greatest ability at that point, and he got tested and pushed and he started to lose confidence. And I think that, you know, the loss of opportunity for him to play has gotten worse and started to backslide. And I know that coaches can tend to be disciplinarians to a bad extent in terms of not knowing how to manage people, where they can overdo it on a certain level. And as a result, the player loses more and more confidence. And I think you're seeing that, and it's showing up in his catches. If he goes somewhere else and they kind of say, we believe in you, and give him those chances, I think you'd see him shine. And I think that's where that opportunity may come, you know, within the next year or two.
Yeah, I think confidence is sort of the key word there. That's kind of where I wanted to go, because when you see him, you know, whether it's Monday night against Seattle or even some other teams, he seems to lack confidence even on a sort of micro level. And when you see him run routes, it seems like he's perhaps unsure of where he's supposed to be or how he needs to get there. When you see him at the catch point, he doesn't seem to sort of attack the football at times like you would expect somebody with his skill set and trait base to do. You know, he had a couple of targets against Seattle where it seemed like, yeah, the passes weren't where they needed to be. They weren't exactly precise, but he could have gone and gotten them, and he sort of let the ball get into him a bit. And it's that speaks to the lack of confidence that he has right now. And when you lack that confidence, you're not going to get the opportunities that you need to sort of work out of it. And Kyle Shanahan basically said as much this week, saying, you know, he's not going to keep getting these opportunities because of the way he's been playing. And so I think it might be a situation where a change of scenery would do him some good. I'm sure some teams would love to have a receiver with his skill set, but the confidence right now seems to be lacking, and it's showing up on tape, and you can see with your own eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's in a vicious cycle now. So I think that pretty much you can close the door on him in San Francisco unless, you know, he comes in next year and just blows the top off of them in spring camp. And I don't know if he'll be around that long.
Yeah. Speaking of guys, however, that do not lack for confidence, there's two quarterbacks you could put in that category. One we saw on the sidelines wearing sunglasses, and that's Lamar Jackson. The other is the last, you know, most recent number one overall pick, Kyler Murray. And so guys that have confidence, Matt, but you got to pick one of them. Which is it, Jackson or Murray?
I'm taking Jackson, and as good as Murray is as a passer, and probably a better passer in certain regards, where Jackson may never improve to that point, which is, you know, the perimeter and the high velocity throws to the perimeter. I think I love what you can do with Jackson as a runner, what you can do with him, how he plays in the pocket. I think he's a superior pocket player to Kyler Murray. And while you have to do different things with Jackson, probably to get the best out of him, we've seen what we get with Baltimore in terms of how they've done that. And I just think that I would rather have an offense that is different than all the other ones you prepare for every week. So that opponents aren't used to playing that type of offense. And I'd rather have Jackson for a shorter period of time than Kyler Murray for maybe another 3 to 4 years worth of time, because I think that the benefits, the dividends that you're paying, that you're going to get out of this offense will tend to be higher year after year with Jackson in his prime than with a player like Murray, as good as he's going to become.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer, Matt. And I'm going to take a time out here because I do want to dive into this a little bit, because I think both quarterbacks have been impressive this season, and both quarterbacks to an extent have sort of surpassed expectations people may have rightly or wrongly had for them. I mean, obviously there's the whole Lamar Jackson and how he was viewed coming out, which we're going to get to in a second. But with Murray, you know, I thought that he was a much better pocket passer than he was given credit for. And I know others shared that, but there are other people that didn't really share that vision, didn't really share that view of him. But I think he's shown that he has that to him. Also, the mechanics that he uses and the ability that he has to make throws from a variety of platforms has led some to wonder whether we have placed too much of a premium on mechanics, or perhaps whether we should be looking at players with baseball backgrounds, because you can see what he can do thrown from different platforms. But I'm going to go with Jackson as well. And it's not because of what I just saw him do to the New England Patriots defense a couple of weeks ago and just tearing them apart. But it's the concept of competitive toughness. And it's one of those traits that it's like Justice Potter Stewart said about pornography. You'll know it when you see it. But it matters so much at the quarterback position. It matters perhaps more than anything else, that ability to sort of inspire those around you, that ability to sort of fight through adversity. It's the reason why I missed on Dak Prescott, and when I revisited my evaluation of him, I had competitive toughness in my notes, but I just didn't weigh it properly. And then the next draft cycle, Deshaun Watson was my QB1, primarily because of competitive toughness. You see that in Lamar Jackson, and you see it in moments like on the sidelines before fourth down in Seattle on the road, where he's imploring John Harbaugh to go forward, and he's turning the sidelines and he's yelling at the rest of the guys on the offense, don't you want to go forward? And what do? They go forward and he runs it in for a touchdown. There's quieter moments when we just saw this past week against Cincinnati, where he and Harbaugh are sitting on the sidelines and Harbaugh is telling him, rather powerfully, I might add, you know, how many kids are going to be wearing number 8 jerseys thinking they can be you? And Lamar's like, that's great, but I just want to win a Super Bowl. But I want to focus on another moment. The locker room after their week 1 win against Miami, when he was getting a game ball and the cameras caught him mimicking a running back and saying, running back though, right? Running back though, right? he still feels that way. And if you think about the great ones, your Jordans, your Gretzky's, your Brady's, they all have that ability to manufacture that chip. Tom Brady right now, greatest quarterback of all time probably, still thinks he's picked 199. Jordan's Hall of Fame speech, again, went into it and talked about guys that made the high school basketball team over him. Lamar Jackson is still going to be proven people wrong, proven people that said he should play running back, that he should be wide receiver. He's got that chip. He's got that competitive toughness chip. And so if I'm building a team, I'm taking Lamar Jackson.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And I think that that's I think those are astute points, and I couldn't have said it better myself. I think it's just one of those things that this is part of the intangible, because leadership is so important. And when you have a player who leads the way he does, he's a quiet guy, but he's vocal when he needs to be, as opposed to some guys who say, like Marcus Mariota, who's like, he has a leadership by example style, but he doesn't raise his voice and doesn't come arise to the moment from a communication standpoint, the way we've seen with Jackson.
Yeah. And I think those are all, you know, great points about, especially Mariota too, because we've seen him sort of struggle with it in a sense. So, okay, we just got done picking our quarterback to build a team around, but we got fired. So we get a new gig, Matt, and we get a chance to build around another quarterback. Which one of these two quarterbacks are you taking? The aforementioned Dak Prescott or Carson Wentz?
Well, listen, you know, Carson Wentz is a guy that, you know, people tend to think I pick on here, but he is an extremely good quarterback. And he's a guy that, if you want to talk about competitive toughness, he might be the most competitively tough quarterback in the league. He's in the top five, I think. And there are a number of competitively tough quarterbacks out there. The problem is that he might be number one by a large margin without a governor. And that mm-hmm. and that gets him hurt. That gets him in situations that he maybe shouldn't be in. He's kind of like the boxer with all heart, who's going to, like, you know, take beating after beating, and you should stop the fight, but he's going to keep going anyhow, and he might not have a career for very long. And I worry about that with Carson Wentz. I also noticed, you know, it was just one receiver, just Alshon Jeffrey, pretty much complaining about him. And certainly, you know, there are some times where you're going to have somebody upset about, you know, their targets or how things are working. But when I look at, you know, I look at that and I consider these things, and I look at Dak Prescott, and I love his competitive toughness. I love how he moves around the pocket. I love how he can throw off script, but he also can step up into the pocket and make plays. And he has a better governor or control over the situation in terms of not getting himself beaten up. And he's smart enough to work with a guy like Amari Cooper and let Cooper come to him and suggest things and work with the guy and make the most out of it. And I think when you look at it from that standpoint, I see a smart leader who may not be a picture perfect quarterback, but, you know, he does a lot more than what I'd say the malcontents in Dallas who just expect everyone to be in, you know, a future Hall of Famer. And when they're not, they think they stink. I think Dak Prescott is an underrated quarterback in this league, and I would roll with him immediately.
Yeah, that's a tremendous answer, Matt. And it's really hard not to pick Dak Prescott, because he's, as we're going to talk about in a few minutes, playing at an MVP level, and he does have that competitive toughness. But I will stick with Carson Wentz. And as you were sort of describing him, I couldn't help but sort of make the connection between, you know, the boxer you described, who's just going to fight until he can't fight anymore and go out and take every single punch. And the fact that, look, he plays in Philadelphia, and there's a Rocky statue, you know, a couple of miles away from Lincoln Financial Field, because he sort of fits that mentality like you were describing. If you think back to when we did our first RSP together on Carson Wentz, it was a game from his junior year, and we raised that point. Because he had a run against Illinois State where he scrambled and lowered his helmet and got hit and fumbled, and they were lucky to recover. We were both like, that's great. Don't ever do it again, because you won't last in the NFL. And we're having that conversation now almost 4 years later. Now, so he hasn't changed who he is. But I'm going to still roll with that guy, because that sort of never say die attitude, I sort of like that in a quarterback. I know it might mean we only get three more seasons of Carson Wentz as opposed to maybe 5, 6, 7, 10 more seasons. But I'm going to roll with him because I still see evidence of him. You look at his game against the Bears a couple weeks ago, doing some of the small things that matter too. And so he was my guy then. He's my guy now. I'll go with Carson. Yeah.
Okay.
But again, two great quarterbacks. And we're going to talk about Prescott in a couple of minutes. But first, I got some bad news, Matt. You get fired again. But as it all works in the NFL, you know, you keep getting recycled hires. You get another gig. You get another chance to build a new offense. And now we're going to focus on the running back position. You get to build around either Christian McCaffrey or Dalvin Cook. Which running back are you picking and why?
Yeah, and it's actually a tough call because you look at a guy like Dalvin Cook and, you know, what he does in the screen game is devastating. The way that he moves so efficiently and hits a hole hard. I think that Dalvin Cook is the superior runner from a standpoint of power to Christian McCaffrey. So from an after contact, pushing the pile, wearing the defense down later in games type of thing, he might be the superior player in that regard. But I have to go with Christian McCaffrey. I mean, I think Christian McCaffrey has some of the best vision in the league between the tackles. He's unbelievable as an outside receiver. I don't even think he gets used to the level that he should have. Go watch Austin Eckler against Oakland on Thursday night, and the first play that they run was him inside trips, and he runs an in-breaking route over the middle against zone that Rivers fires to him, and he catches like a receiver, and I go, Christian McCaffrey could do that and more. And the Chargers seem to be the only ones with the cojones to actually do that with their running back. I would love to have Christian McCaffrey and you build him out as a receiver and continue to use him as a running back at the highest level. And if things start to break down a little bit or I want to evolve a little bit, I could maybe move him to the slot and make him a slot receiver down the stretch of his career and continue to use kind of infuse the team with a younger running back and get the most and really bleed every inch of ability out of McCaffrey. So I would roll with him.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I'm going to roll with McCaffrey as well. And I think sort of the distinction becomes, and we'll address it in the next question, Cook's probably the better running back. I think the power, the vision, the footwork, the explosiveness through the line, the way the Vikings use him, he's a better running back. McCaffrey's a better offensive weapon. And if you look at sort of the schematic way in which you can employ him, the things you can do from a conceptual standpoint, the fact that you can put him in the slot and be comfortable there, you can put him on a wing, you can move him around, you can do a lot of different things with him. He's going to make it much tougher to game plan for if you're the opposing defensive coordinator. And so the ability to sort of do different things, the schematic elements that I can bring to the table with him, weigh this decision in favor of Christian McCaffrey. If it was just, look, if you were told, look, you're going to be running, say, what Iowa does on offense with a lot of offset eye and a lot of power and gap run stuff, then I'll take Dalvin Cook. But with the ability to sort of mold an offensive philosophy around one of these players, I'll go with McCaffrey.
Sweet, sweet, sweet. Now, I like the answer.
Oh, go ahead. So let's go to the running back position a bit more. Which running back or running backs in the NFL have 2,000-yard season talent if the supporting cast is right?
Yeah, I think Nick Chubb headlines that. I think that he's – because he's such a great runner between the tackles with every scheme that you want to use him in. It's like you want to run gap. Oh, he can be an excellent gap runner. Inside zone, terrific. Outside zone, I mean, Jake Burns over, you know, over local Cleveland writer, you know, talks about how he's basically a doctorate level running back and outside zone, a genius, makes genius types of plays. And I agree with that. I think that he headlines that list and he has the stamina, strength and speed to break it all the way, get a strong offensive line and complete team around him. And wow, I think this guy could easily be a 2,000-yard back. Ezekiel Elliott still has 2,000 yards in him, I think, with the right setup. And I don't think it's quite the right setup for this team. I mean, the line is still very good, but this is a team that I don't think needs to pound the ball with him to the extent that maybe they had to in the past. But I think that if a team needed to, he has that complete game, that complete skill set to his game that can do that. Obviously, Saquon Barkley, you know, he may be the type of guy that still loses you yards that he shouldn't. And but if you put him on a team like Dallas, I think that you would see him threaten in that regard. So those are the three backs for me that I think have that. And I'll give you an outside shot guy just to end it, that I think will have that opportunity down the line. And I'll say it's Josh Jacobs behind that mammoth Oakland line. I think he has that kind of talent to possibly threaten that, but I don't think he'll get use in that regard either.
That's an interesting name, Jacobs, at the end. You could almost say the same thing about Miles Sanders, because you know, I love the Philadelphia Eagles offensive line. I think they do some great work, and he's starting to figure it out, starting to get some trust in the guys up front like Kelsey and Brandon Brooks. I've been studying that offensive line, but I don't think they're going to use him in that way, but he has that sort of talent, I think, in him. You know, the names you mentioned, obviously Barkley and Elliott and Chubb, I think are all great picks. But I'll circle back to the previous question and say Dalvin Cook. You look at the power, the vision, the footwork, the ability to run through smoke. You know, maybe not as nuanced as a runner as, say, Chubb is. Maybe he doesn't have the sort of doctorate level understanding of outside zone, but you still love the way that they run that outside zone and wide zone with him, the ability to sort of decipher and make decisions based off of that. It's usually what you want to see from your running back, the ability to sort of run through contact at times or run through smoke. And, you know, if he could stay healthy, which might be the biggest question mark with him, I think he's a guy that could hit 2,000. And we know that that's where they want to be as a team. They want to run the ball and throw off of that. So there's a potential that it could come to fruition. He's got almost 1,000 yards already with a number of games left. Could he get there? Probably not. Not this year, but maybe sometime soon.
I love that answer. Yeah, he's an unbelievably skilled player and just so smooth, so smooth. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah, all great running backs. We got a lot of young talent in this league, and we've got some young wide receivers in this league too. And so a similar question, Matt. Which wide receiver or a group of wide receivers could hit that 2,000-yard receiving mark, do you think?
Yeah, this is a much tougher one, but I think Mike Evans could do it. I think with the right quarterback, and I don't think Jameis Winston is the right quarterback, but I think his dominance as a downfield player could really, you know, be a boon for that type of thing. I think Julio Jones in his prime could have been very close to doing that. I'm not sure if he's at the point now where we could really look at it from that standpoint and say that it would have happened. I honestly think that maybe a few years ago in his prime, AJ Green could have done it. And I think AJ Green's career has been an excellent one, but to the level of talent that he has, if he were in an offense with a quarterback who could have really taken advantage of his route running to the degree that, and really his big play ball ability to an even greater degree than we saw, I think he had that opportunity. I think DeAndre Hopkins, on a different team, would probably have a shot at that, because I don't think his route running is leveraged as much to the extent that it could be with another quarterback as good as Deshaun Watson is. Those are the guys that, and I think Odell Beckham Jr. on a different team could obviously be that type of talent too.
Yeah, those are all great answers. And what's interesting is a lot of them, you made the point that on a different team or at a different time, like with Julio, when he was perhaps in his prime, they could have gotten there. But I think that there's a guy in the moment that could do it, and that's Tyreek Hill. And it's interesting because, you know, they have so many weapons on that offense, but he's put up some big yardage numbers, and he has that big playability, and he has the quarterback that, as we know and love, is willing to do the kind of audacious things you might need as a receiver to get to that mythical number of 2,000 as a receiver. And so I think Hill has a legitimate shot to do it. Building off of what you were saying, and guys that maybe in a different set of circumstances could do it, I'd say Stephon Diggs. You know, whenever I get a chance to just sit down and watch a route runner, he's a guy I like to sit down and watch, you know, because of the footwork, the leverage, the whole body route running. I think he has that ability. And maybe I could put Amari Cooper in that mix as well, because there's another guy that I love to watch from a route running standpoint. Those are guys that have the talent, but I think Hill might have a legitimate shot to do it.
Yeah, and with all those big plays that they throw, I mean, when you get chunk plays like that, and then you get your 100 running typical routes, yeah, that's probably the best answer of the day when it comes to that question.
Yeah, I mean, but all great options. AJ Green, I know we're going to get to him in a second, but I think in his prime, he probably could have done it too. But we'll step aside from 2,000-yard numbers for a second and talk big picture, MVP. Matt, who's your midseason MVP?
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty obvious answer for a lot of people, because that's all everyone pretty much talked about, is that than it would be Russell Wilson. And I think that there are other guys who can contend with that. But I think that, I think I'm going to actually change my answer midstream. Ooh. As much as I love Russell Wilson, and I think that he's a great player and he probably deserves it, I'm going to say no player has actually stirred the drink of his team more than Lamar Jackson.
Yeah.
And I just think that, he may have not as made as many big plays and be as relied upon as Russell Wilson. And I would probably still give my vote to Wilson. I guess I want to spend a little bit of time just to give a shout out to Jackson, because I think the fact that when you change your entire offense in a way that's completely different from the rest of the NFL to fit around a player, that player better be good. That player better do it right. He better not screw it up. And Jackson plays his role perfectly and gives even a little more than I think what we saw from guys like Colin Kaepernick in the past, or Michael Vick in this offense. And they've taken it to another level, and that's a lot of credit goes to him. Who's your MVP?
Yeah, I actually wrote on this like 2 weeks ago over a Pro Football Week, where I sort of handicapped the MVP race just from the quarterback standpoint. And I made a case for really three young guys. I said Rodgers and Wilson, they're probably like the guys with the inside track. Maybe Rodgers has slipped a bit, but Wilson certainly looks like he's in the mix for the MVP case, just like you said. But I made a case for Lamar Jackson, and the numbers sort of bear that out. When you look at what he's done, what he's meant to that offense, both as a runner and a thrower. I made him a case for Patrick Mahomes because, if he comes back from this injury and they make a run, you can make a strong case for Patrick Mahomes, even though he might not be there now. He might be a safe sort of futures type bet. And I'm going to make a case now for the third guy I mentioned, and that's Dak Prescott. And I know that this team, look, they're 5-4 what right now? And it's 5-5. Yeah, 5-5 maybe. They're not winning games like you expect to see from your MVP. But he's playing at an extremely high level. Like tops in the league in so many different categories, whether it's QBR or just a net yards per attempt, EPA per dropback, all that kind of stuff. He's been incredible to watch. And if they go on a run, he's going to be an inside favorite to win, I think. And so even though the team hasn't won the kind of games, the number of games that they'd like to have won, I think there's a big case to be made for Prescott.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And it's just funny. I mean, how you look at players, and you see how they can kind of fly under the radar the way that he has. And I think that he's definitely deserving of that being in the conversation.
Yeah. I mean, if they were like 7-3 right now, I think it'd be a clear 3-person race between Lamar and Prescott and Russell Wilson. But since they're 5-5 or whatever, he just flies the radar. So,
yeah.
But speaking of flying, Matt, you sometimes have a no-fly list when it comes to fantasy football and guys that you would just not pick up under any set of circumstances. You mentioned before Dante Moncrief is one. Who are some others? Who's on your no-fly list?
Yeah, and to me, it even extends beyond like fantasy football. It extends to like if I were getting a chance to play GM and these guys were available, I would be looking elsewhere. I think another guy that's on that list for me is Kalen Ballage. I think that as a running back, this guy is very limited in terms of what he can do beyond from a conceptual standpoint. And I think it's very important to be able to have that kind of, to kind of have a certain level of awareness and instincts to run the ball. And I just don't think he has them, and I don't think he's ever going to get them. Jameis Winston would be on my no fly list. And it's one of those situations where he's extremely talented and you see it every week. But it's just every week it's one or two throws. Sometimes it's three or four that are just he doesn't have the composure. He doesn't have the mindset, if you ask me, to be that to make the right decision. He's always tempted by the wrong decision. He's like that kid in your family who's now grown up to an adult and they just can't pick the right partner. And like they're always like picking someone where there's just they get dragged through like crazy drama and they can't stop doing it. I think Jameis Winston is that way when it comes to looking downfield. He always pulls himself into drama. Who's on your no-fly list?
Yeah, I think it's getting bigger and bigger by the week. I mean, I think you're going to start – look, I mentioned this guy when we did the first quick game, and it's Ben Roethlisberger. I just don't like the guy, like, period, full stop. Like, he's a good quarterback, fine.
Bramble's clapping right now.
Yeah, I just don't like him, period. Marcus Mariota, unfortunately, has to be there. It pains me because I loved him coming out, but I think we've sort of seen what he's going to be in the National Football League. And like we talked about the last time, he's probably going to get a shot, but I just have no faith in it at this point. Mitchell Trubisky absolutely positively has to be on there again because he is who he is. He's the same quarterback right now in the National Football League in his third season, having vapor lock on route concepts that most high school quarterbacks can pick apart. So I can't buy into him. I know Chicago area is kind of excited because he had one good throw against Detroit, which I, yes, wrote about and tried to make the case that maybe it's signs of growth, but he's still on the no-fly list. And finally, any Patriots running back, just because I have spent the better part of my new professional career trying to figure out how they're going to use running backs offensively, and I've yet to crack the code. I've just given up on it. So Patriots running backs, I just stay away from them. I just can't do it anymore.
Good enough.
Yeah. It just, I get asked every show I come on, like somebody inevitably will ask, like, oh, what should we do with Sony Michel this week? I have no idea. Start him, sit him, drop him, trade him. I don't know. I just don't know anymore. So it gets frustrating. What can I say?
Yeah.
Speaking of frustrations, Bengals fans, they don't know what to expect now from AJ Green. If you were advising Mr. Green, Matt, what would your advice be? What would you tell him to do?
Something that would go against every instinct that he has as a player, which is sit your ass down and do not play the rest of this year and get a new contract somewhere else. No one's going to count that against you in the league. They know you're a great player. You have nothing left to prove, and you don't need to get hurt playing with some rookie quarterback on a team that just doesn't have what it takes to really compete at a level that it needs to. And why risk the rest of the remainder of your career to do that? You could wind up on some teams that could really benefit you, and you can help teach some other players. If you want to be on a team that will, like, you know, be in that window of contention, I'm sure that Seattle will make more room. I'm sure Dallas would make more room. I'm sure that Baltimore would consider you. And even though you may not get to run some of those perimeter routes, you're still a good inside breaking route runner who I would love to see you continue to, like, just bedevil the AFC North on that level. Or I'd like to see Cleveland, you know, I feel like I'm just like picking on Baker Mayfield, but I'd like to see Cleveland trade for a different quarterback, and then they won't be able to do all that they would do there. But I think there's a lot of places that Green could go, and he just does not need to get hurt again. Just let him rest up and be ready for the free agent era.
I think that's exactly right, Matt. I would basically just adopt your answer almost word for word, because there's nothing else he has to prove right now. And getting hung out to dry by Ryan Finley throwing hospital balls is not the way to sort of get that next deal. So sit down, watch the rest of the season, put the feet up, make some, you know, hot spiced apple cider, put a little cinnamon stick in it. That's nice this time of year. And just be a spectator, because you're not going to prove anything. Get ready for 2020.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, speaking of people perhaps coming back from injury, Minshew Mania is over. Nick Foles back in the lineup. Now, Matt, what do you expect from Nick Foles, and who do you think benefits?
I think he attacks downfield. I think that's what we're going to see a lot from him. He's going to work to try and make a fair bit of trust throws in the process of that. I think you're going to see an aggressive passer in many respects that you also saw from Gardner Minshew, just maybe a little bit more astute at doing so in certain situations. We'll see. But I think that you'll see him attack, and guys that will benefit from that, DJ Chark will continue to benefit. I think we're going to see DD Westbrook and him continue to hook up well. And I think that you'll see a little more out of him and Chris Conley. Conley, you know, he and Conley had a nice rapport in the offseason, as well as what they did when they had worked together in Kansas City. So I think that that's possibly there. I think the guy that benefits the least might be Keelan Cole, which is too bad because he was starting to get his way back into the lineup. I hope I'm wrong about that, because I still think he has the talent to be a really strong wide receiver too in this league, in the way that he goes up and wins the ball and what he can do in terms of the middle of the field. So I hope he continues his comeback there, but we'll see what happens with the relationship with Foles. What about you, Mark? What do you think about Foles?
Well, I mean, I think you're right sort of in the short term that he's going to come back into the lineup. We know Foles is an aggressive passer. When he sees cover one, when he sees press man coverage, he likes to go vertical. He likes to go downfield. I think J.J. Chark's going to get some downfield opportunities like he was getting with Minshew, and I think Westbrook will as well. And so in the short term, I think those guys might benefit. You might see the tight ends, whether it's Oliver or DeValve, they might get some extra targets as well. We know Foles likes throwing to the tight ends. But I think in the long term, the person who benefits most is Gardner Minshew. And, you know, you've written about this. I've written about this as well. In terms of sort of handling young quarterbacks, sometimes there is a benefit to letting them sort of sit down. And while this wasn't the sort of design that Jacksonville might have had in mind for how to handle Gardner Minshew and get him some exposure, look, Minshew mania became a thing. People were enthralled by what he was doing. And then he struggled a little bit. He got dinged up and beaten up a little bit. Had some interceptions last time they were out against Houston across the pond. And so this is a nice situation for him to sort of sit back, catch his breath, not be in the limelight, learn a little bit. And I think this sets him up to be in a very good position next year where he can push for the starter job by merit, not by injury. And so short term, the receivers we mentioned, long term, I think this is good for Gardner Minshew.
Yeah, I think that makes total sense. And I think it is too. And I'm excited about how his career is going to unfold.
Now, speaking of the guy, perhaps at the tail end of his career, maybe, question mark, who knows? Or maybe he's on to a new career. We just don't know. We never know with this guy. Rob Gronkowski, Matt, is he coming back or not?
I don't think he is. I mean, when someone talks about not getting sleep for the amount of time he talked about while dealing with injury, listen, you know, if you're in your teens or your 20s or even your early 30s and listening to this, most of you at that age, you just don't understand. You don't get it. Like not getting sleep is usually due to some fun things, you know, and or something that you're trying to achieve a goal and you're burning the candle at both ends because you have the energy and you have to create the energy to finish your degree or do some, or you're in a career and you're doing something on that level, but you're not dealing with pain. If you're ill and dealing with pain and your body needs rest, and you're fatigued on that level and you can't sleep because of that pain, trust me when I tell you that that is torture. And he went through torture, I think, on a level that I don't think he's coming back from that. I think that he's in a good place. And I think that while the ability to be cute and flirt with it a little bit or leave people guessing may be fun for him, I don't think he's coming back. What do you think?
I think you're exactly right. And let's think about it this way. We know Rob Gronkowski is the outgoing, brash, smart, fun guy, quirky guy to be around, the Gronk spikes, the overblown media personality. And when he had that press conference, when he announced that he was going to do the sponsorship thing with that CBD company, and he talked about what he was going through, to see him break up, to see him start to cry when he was thinking about what he went through and where he was and the dark place he was, that was a deeply sobering moment in a sense. I think for most football fans, at least, you know, if not just Patriots fans, hopefully more, because we think about this game and we cover this game and we love this game, but yet there are human beings playing this game. And those of us that have, you know, played this game even to such a small degree like I did, you know, I'm sitting here right now, it's Wednesday afternoon, 1:14 p.m., and I'm in my basement office and I've got below me these chirp wheels. They're these things I saw on Instagram that are supposed to help with back pain. And my back hurts sitting here right now. And the second we get done recording, I'm going to throw my body on one of these things and try to make my back feel better. And that's just a kid that played D3, not somebody that was trying to get his body ready to go out and block the Khalil Max of the world and make catches against the Earl Thomases of the Cam Chancellors of the world. And so this game can take a toll on you, can exact a toll on you. And when you get away from it and you experience life again the way it's meant to be lived, perhaps, you're not going to go back. There's no way he's coming back.
Yeah, I agree. So for the sake of your back, do we have another 10 minutes left in us?
Oh, of course we got another 10 minutes left in us. Like I said, look, we power through, you know, you play through pain, both on the field and on the podcast. And speaking of tight ends, Matt, the best NFL tight end that nobody's talking about?
That's a good question. And you know, from a fantasy perspective, you could probably say Gerald Everett, the way that he runs routes, what he does after the catch, you know, and how he's been performing. He's really making an impact at that level. But I'm going to go with a rookie. And I think it's Irv Smith Jr. Mm-hmm. I think Irv Smith Jr. is a fantastic young tight end who, even though Kyle Rudolph's playing well, even though they don't need Irv Smith to be the primary guy, watching him block, watching the variety of blocks that he makes, and then in addition to that, what he can do as a route runner and after the catch, I think this guy's going to be a Pro Bowl tight end at some point in the league. And it may take him a little longer because of the fact that he still has Rudolph in fold, but I've been super impressed with his game. How about you? Who's the tight end that you like who no one's talking about?
Well, I mean, this might be cheating because at least I know, like, in the fantasy world, people are talking about this guy, but he's not being talked about sort of on the national level that I think it's worthy of mention, and that's Darren Waller from Oakland. Yeah. And you watch this Oakland offense, and I remember you and I this summer saying that Oakland was close to piecing it together, and it seems like they've done so. And part of the reason is because of Waller. When you see how they use him as a sort of a vertical threat, you see how they use him as almost a big slot at times. Like, it's one thing to get like an isolated route against a linebacker deep downfield. It's another thing to see him running mesh and running shallow crossers and making catches working full speed across the formation on basically a route that was designed for Jerry Rice in a sense. Now he's running it and running away from guys. Incredible athlete, explosive after the catch, big catch radius. There's a reason Oakland is in the mix now in the AFC West, and it starts with their offense. And yes, the addition of Jacobs has been huge. Carr is playing well, but Waller is a big part of that. I think the team needs to – I mean, I think the national media needs to take a notice. Fantasy, obviously, fantasy players were ahead of the curve here, but definitely Darren May.
Like it. Absolutely. Now he's been fantastic, and they have definitely used him in more ways than what they did down the stretch of last season. So John Gruden obviously saw in practice what was going on and where the future was heading.
Yeah. Speaking of young players, you like to talk about the second contract a lot, Matt. You talk about it with the quarterback position, but here we're going to frame it around the wide receiver position. Who is the best second contract wide receiver prospect in the NFL? Maybe a non-starter right now who will become a good starter when he gets that second deal.
Well, you know, I would love to say from the fact that I've touted Dante Pettis from last year that it'll be him. But obviously he has a long way to go right now due to that loss of confidence in the situation he's in. But I think, you know, and I talked about Keelan Cole as a guy who I think is digging himself out of that grave that Pettis was in. And it was something that Keenan McCardell, his coach, talked about last summer, saying that he's getting better. But the guy for me is Josh Reynolds with the Rams. Josh Reynolds, you know, when he came out at Texas A&M, he was kind of known as a fade route guy who wasn't extremely fast, who, you know, was kind of a one-dimensional player to many people. But I saw some really good route running from him, some evidence of, or at least the tools to become a really good route runner. And then he gets into this offense, and you see the flashes of it. Like, they never throw the routes that are like his money routes. Like, they knew at Texas A&M, he's playing the game that the offense wants him to play, and he does it well when he gets on the field. And he's a tough guy who makes the plays in the middle of the field. You know, he breaks back to the ball well. He runs in breaking routes extremely well. There's some skill after the catch there. I think he's what teams that keep going to Dante Moncrief and dialing him up and hoping they can get something out of him. I think one team is going to pick him up and go, maybe he'll give us a little bit of what teams are getting from Dante Moncrief, and they'll get what was actually expected out of Moncrief when he was drafted. I think this guy's going to be a good one. How about you?
That's a great answer, Matt. Interesting analysis there. I'm going to go with Darius Slayton. And Ooh. This is a weird one, but, you know, covering the Giants in a sense like I do, I've gotten a chance to sort of see what he's becoming at the infant stages of his career here. And I like him for two reasons. When you see him, you see explosiveness and you see a massive catch radius. I like the way they can use him vertical down the field. They can use him along the sidelines. I like the way he sometimes wins some contested throws. But it's that last point there that I sort of creep into the other reason. His relationship with Daniel Jones. And we see this sometimes with, you know, younger quarterbacks that start running, you know, second team reps when they get those sort of reserve wide receivers that they're thrown to during training camp. They build that relationship. That's now playing out where Jones is the starter, and due to injuries, Slayton's a starter now as well. And so there's a relationship between the two of them that is fluid, that is growing. There's a trust there between the two of them that, you know, sometimes in situations you will see Daniel Jones look for Darius Slayton first on plays when you might not expect him to, given the route concept. And so because of that, I think there are going to be a lot of opportunities for him to show what he could do as a receiver. And I think by the time he starts looking for his second deal, he's going to be somebody to keep an eye on.
I love that answer. Yeah, he's played extremely well. And the way that you outline that gives just great argument for it.
All right, Matt, we're closing down. We got two more questions here. We're going to go a little bit away from the field itself so much. First one is this. A football moment in your youth that left an indelible imprint on your appreciation of the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when you start watching, you just remember plays that got you into the sport, that you realized you loved the sport, that it was a source of fascination for you. So, you know, I remember things like watching Ozzie Newsome catch passes up the seam one-handed, you know, with guys blanketing him, or Ken Burrow, who was a wide receiver for the Houston Oilers, who wore double zero. He wore 2 zeros and he was catching a deep post and just being enamored with a player catching the deep post. Or John Jefferson, the former Chargers wide receiver, who was just a fantastic acrobatic player with Dan Fouts, who had a lot of flair to his game too, and wore those racquetball goggles that Eric Dickerson had. But I think the most indelible moment for me was watching Jack Tatum hit Earl Campbell at the goal line and send Campbell, you know, stumbling backwards and still finding a way to fall over the goal line. And just the sheer raw power and just the, I would say, the viciousness of the game of football, the physicality of the game of football at that time was just awe-inspiring to me to watch players and what they could do in those types of moments. And I think that really solidified for me that I was hooked on this game, was not only just the acrobatics from the things I mentioned, but really just the sheer will and physicality of the game that just appealed to me on a gut level. How about you?
Yeah, that's a great answer, Matt. I'm going to go with Super Bowl 23 and Montana's drive to win it against the Bengals. And it's because at the time I was a young kid playing Pop Warner who was wearing number 16, you know, because of Joe Montana. And that's who I wanted to be. And to see in that moment the level of excellence that he had in those closing minutes on that drive, you know, and then to hear the sort of the stories after. Look, I we'll get to the stories after in a second, but I remember watching that game with my family and what he hit Taylor for the touchdown to go ahead in the closing seconds. I remember I was sitting on, you know, facing the television. I'm on the left side of the TV. I get up from the floor and I like start jumping up and down and screaming, running into the, you know, front foyer. And, you know, I'm a, you know, 10, 11 year old kid at the time, almost hitting my head on the doorway, on the top of the doorway, because I was so excited. I had probably never even jumped that high in my life. And then, you know, that moment in and of itself, you know, it was something I'll never forget. And it's something that left me with, you know, just the beauty and the execution and the precision with which people can play this position in the game's most critical moments. But then you hear sort of after the stories, you know, before the drive, when he gets into the huddle and says to everybody, hey, look, there's John Candy standing in the end zone eating popcorn. It's like, this is the game of your lives. This is the Super Bowl. And you're like pointing that out. And then, like, they come out of the TV timeout and he's right back into, you know, full on football mode. And when he's hyperventilated near the end of that drive and they have to burn a timeout because he's so excited. That just, you know, I was probably hooked already, but that, if I hadn't been, that would have been the moment that did it. You know, seeing Montana in that moment. And then, look, I get to do it later, you know, some 15, 20 years later when I become a Patriots fan, you know, after my Montana phase, and you see Tom Brady start doing it. And so it was that Montana drive, though, that really kicked off.
It's funny because I remember that drive, but I never saw it live because I was a freshman at the University of Miami and listening to it on the radio in my dorm room.
Oh, wow.
I remember I don't know why. I don't think we had a TV, and we didn't have a TV at the time in our dorm room. So I listened to that game, and I listened to the Frank Reich comeback against the Warren Moon and the Oilers on the radio because we had a storm and it cut off and for some reason our cable was cut off. So I had to listen to the second half on the radio.
Well, Matt, this is going to be the last time we have a quick game episode before Thanksgiving, unless we do one on, you know, Thanksgiving Eve, perhaps. So in the event that we don't reconvene before the holiday, give the gentle listeners, well, we might, you never know, but in the event we don't,
that's true.
Give the gentle listeners sort of an overview, a bird's eye view of the Waldman Thanksgiving. Is there a football game? Is everybody watching TV? What's going down? What's the spread like?
Yeah, see, Thanksgiving's my absolute favorite holiday, and I think for me it was the holiday.
Thank you.
Yeah, just for growing up, it was the holiday. For me, it was growing up, it was the holiday that we didn't have to go anywhere else. So it was, we had it at our house, and so I've always kind of made it a tradition in my family that friends and family are welcome to come over, but I'm not going anywhere. That's generally the case. And so I like to cook, and so I usually cook, and I'll make turkey different ways. It can be one year I'll fry it, one year I'll, one year I'll boil it in oil. I don't remember the exact term that you use for that, but I'll do that. One year I'll spatchcock it and roast it. And then some years we won't even do turkey. It just depends. Sometimes I'll just ask, what would you rather? Would you rather have something other than turkey? Some years I've made Thanksgiving where I've done stuffing that I've made stuffing waffles, and had turkey and waffles. So we'll do some kind of funky and fun things with that. Usually, it's turkey, but usually it'll be, turkey, the stuffing that I like, that my wife really likes that I make, and a few different sides, whether it's greens or my daughter Chandler, who won't be with us this year because she's serving, she's in the Marine Corps and she's finishing up her training. She just left for Arizona last week. So she'll be in Arizona and probably with my dad who just moved out there. So they may kidnap her for a little bit for Thanksgiving and have that with her. But that'll be interesting because my family's Jewish and my daughter loves the ham. So I'm interested to see whether or not how that's going to go. But usually we get a ham for Chandler, and she likes, I slow cook a ham for her, and that's something that she likes. We usually watch movies. I used to be all about the Thanksgiving football, and probably before I had a family, I think about being in Jamaica, and the first time I had fried turkey was with this Cajun dude who was in Jamaica, and we watched Randy Moss, score three touchdowns against the Cowboys. And I remember frying a turkey and worrying about my fantasy lineup and thinking I should start. What's the name of that dude? I can't believe I forgot his name, but he was the slot receiver for the Colts, who ended up being a radio host for the Broncos that Cecil works with, who I didn't start him, and he scored like three touchdowns in that game. And I remember losing.
What's his name?
Yeah.
This is going to bug me.
Stanford kid, I think. Maybe. No, it wasn't Stan. I don't remember his name. But yeah, I remember that. But otherwise, I usually watch the games later now. I just record them and I'll watch them the next day. But usually it's just us hanging out and playing games or throughout the day and I cook usually the night before and during that day, and we eat early afternoon and just have a good time laughing. And this year, and occasionally now that we're empty nesters a bit, we'll go out to eat occasionally on a Thanksgiving, but this year I felt like cooking and we have a friend coming over. So we should have a good time this Thanksgiving. What's it like in the Schofield household?
Yeah. Well, first off, Brandon Stokely,
That's it. Brandon Stokely.
Yeah, I had to look
that up. I've even met him. And I was like thinking that I remember looking at him and thinking, I remember how upset I was that I didn't start you that one year because I almost did. And then I got up early to go get ready to get the turkey fryer. And I got so preoccupied with that, that I forgot to put him back in the lineup, or I thought I did and I didn't. And then I remember losing and thinking, you know, that was one of those tough defeats nobody cares about other than yourself.
Right. Right. Yeah. I'm similar to you in that I absolutely love Thanksgiving. I get frustrated at times with the people that go from Halloween to Christmas and the holiday season.
Yeah.
Because it's like you're skipping the good one here in Thanksgiving. You know, I have such a fond, you know, soft spot for it. We were the opposite of you growing up. We would always be the ones, like, we would have Thanksgiving and then we would go to like a couple of different houses for extended family. And so, you know, but now we host every year and it's going to be exciting for us this year because we get the new house and, you know, a lot more room. And so I'm really excited about doing that. We always do turkey the same way. Martha Stewart, lots of butter, lots of white wine. We do two different stuffings because I have the old school from my side of the family, like the sausage Italian stuffing from the North End. So that's what we do. And I'm basically the only one that eats it now because even my side of the family, my mom and dad love the Midwestern stuffing that my wife was raised on, which has raisins and you use the giblets and you use like the turkey stock and you even put the neck in there as well. It's got water chestnuts. It's a lot, two very different stuffings, but we make both. And you know, the Knievel family stuffing is the one that goes into the bird. So we make those. This year I'm excited because I got a new Traeger smoker / grill, and I'm going to do a smoked mac and cheese as one of the side dishes. So, you know, we love doing it that way. Everybody brings like a dessert or something like so. I'll start cooking like the Saturday before with cookies and stuff, and I love doing it all. We typically watch a ton of football. We don't really play football. Well, that might change this year. Again, we're in the new house and my son's like new best friend lives basically diagonal across the street and his dad's a football coach. And they've got like tackling dummies in the backyard and a huge backyard. They've got like pylons and stuff. And so once my son usually gets home from school and does his homework, he runs across the street and I'll be like tackling dummies until it gets dark. And so there might be some football to be played this year. I don't know, but usually it's all about the food and spending time with family. And then I allow myself, I will turn on the holiday lights. I put them up when it's warm out, like I just did them last weekend, and get them ready, but I will not turn them on until the night of Thanksgiving because that's when it's okay. You can start thinking about the holiday season and Christmas and Hanukkah. So the holiday lights will go on. And I will say this, Matt, our house has a reputation in this neighborhood we move into as the blue house because the previous owner would go wall to wall, front yard and back. Anything that could have a light stapled or glued or hooked to it had a light on it to the point where people would come and drive to our neighborhood to see what this house looked like. And I can't live up to that. And so I am just – my wife and I are terrified that we're going to get people like booing us. Like they'll drive in from their neighborhoods across from Maryland and like boo us and egg the house because we're not going to have those kinds of lights. Now we are going to do two trees at the end of the driveway, two little like small trees – in blue as a sort of hat tip and a homage to the previous owner, but it's not going to be the kind of lights that people are expecting to see. So I'm worried that, you know, Christmas season, I'm going to have lots of eggshells to clean up around the yard. People getting disappointed when they get let down by us, but that's a story for another time, perhaps.
Well, eggshells are a good fertilizer. So,
you know, can have a great yard next year.
See, there you go. Exactly. So listen, we hope that you have a fantastic Thanksgiving, filled with, you know, friends and family and, you know, good food and great conversations. And, you know, that we always have here at the Quick Game with Mark and I. You know, I'll just say right away that I'm very thankful that Mark Schofield works at the Rookie Scouting Portfolio and joins me on this show every week. We have a great time doing this, and he's a fantastic football resource if you want to learn more about the game and just want to be entertained by, you know, quality work that he does. So, you know, on behalf of Mark and me, you can follow Mark at Mark Schofield on Twitter. You can find him at Pro Football Weekly, Big Blue Review, you know, Pat's Pulpit, and, you know, a variety of other places, of course, like the RSP. And you can find me at Matt Waldman on Twitter, and you can subscribe to this podcast on pretty much any outlet that you use to subscribe to podcasts. And please rate and review it if you feel so inclined. And if you want to give us more extensive feedback, positive or otherwise, drop me a line at mattwaldmanrsp@gmail.com. And, you know, I'll be sure to get back with you and have a conversation with you at some point about that. And you guys have a great weekend, and may, you know, all your bold calls with the NFL come true.